Early in the 1990s, and I don't recall which year, I went on a brief press trip to Albania, courtesy of an Italian drinks bottling company that had opened a facility in that country. It was a strange experience. After we landed on a visibly potholed runway at Tirana Airport, Tirana is the capital, the press pack was taken by coach to the bottling plant, which was outside of some town. The roads were pretty poor and there were still horse-drawn carts trundling along them, though, as I recall, the scenery was hilly and spectacular. I do remember thinking that it would be an attractive tourist destination if there was the infrastructure, you know, the hotels, the roads and so on, in place. Outside the bottling plant, there seemed to be a lot of people wandering up and down the road for no apparent reason. And once we'd been shown around the place, I thought I'd join them for a stroll. One of the things I'd noticed on the trip from the airport was a profusion of pillboxes and bunkers, mushroom-shaped structures made of concrete that were strewn everywhere, I meant really everywhere. So I decided to walk up the hillside opposite and take a look at one of them. This was a pillbox designed to hold one soldier and his rifle. Now, I'm no expert, but it looked like a death trap to me. It had come off its foundations and was lying on its side. I've no idea why. It really didn't look to be a promising way of avoiding death by tank shell. I've seen various numbers for these structures. 700,000, 500,000, 170,000, one for every 11 people, 5.7 bunkers for every square kilometre, that's 14.7 per square mile, and so on. There are a lot, and they were, they still are, a visible testament to the stormy past that Albania was emerging from, and also to the paranoia about a potential invasion that had previously afflicted its leadership. The Albanian coast lies about 70 kilometres east of the heel of the Italian peninsula, and its mountains are visible from Italy across the Strait of Otranto. This is the part of the world known as the Balkans, one of the more turbulent bits of the European landmass, and the setting for the most recent shooting war on the continent. It's more peaceful now, which isn't to say it's like a visit to Munich or Manchester. But back in the early 90s, the Bosnian War was brewing. It was fought out between 1992 and 1995. And the various communist regimes still around on the continent had recently fallen or been overthrown. The Albanian regime, installed by communist partisans after World War II, was among these. The regime had taken a path that most closely resembles North Korea, under a guy called Enver Hoxha. It had closed itself off to most of the rest of the world to pursue some sort of weird Stalinist purity, a command economy initially funded mainly by the bigger communist states, starting with the USSR. At a certain point, however, Hoxha fell out with the USSR, and in 1961, he switched his allegiance to Mao's China. That lasted until 1978, when the alliance ended, and a constitutional ban on all forms of foreign credit cut in. The economy, which in any case was massively misallocating resources, stumbled on for a few years, but by the beginning of the 90s, it was crumbling. Hoxha died in 1985 and was replaced by Ramiz Aliyev, the leader of the Communist Party. The country only began to democratise following student protests in late 1990, after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Because of its recent history, and because basically no one outside really cared that much about a small country in a remote area that was essentially damaging mainly itself, there isn't actually much detailed information about the place. That's forced me to rely on reports written for the benefit of international development organisations like the IMF, the World Bank and the EBRD, as the place opened up. These people are development economists, not journalists, so if this episode of the podcast is a little short on colour, that's why. Here's a taste from a report called From Isolation to Ward Reform, prepared for the IMF in 1992. Quote, until the beginning of 1991, and for more than four decades, Albania was one of the least known and less accessible countries in the world. It secluded itself in self-imposed isolation and was ruled by an authoritarian regime that professed to adhere strictly to Marxist ideology and Stalinist practices in an attempt to carry out one of the most far-reaching experiments in socialist orthodoxy. Although not much was known about the country's economy, Albania was usually characterised as the poorest and least developed nation in Europe, probably the only one on the continent with standards of living resembling third world countries. Although initially regarded as a bastion of resistance against the radical changes taking place in the socialist world, Albania had, by the middle of 1991, joined the reform movement sweeping through Eastern Europe. In June 1991, the first non-communist, multi-party coalition government in the post-war era was formed. Diplomatic relations with many countries were renewed, and Albania joined the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, among other international organisations. To put some meat on the bones of that, Albania is about 29,000 square kilometres, which is 30-odd percent bigger than Wales, which checks in at about 22,000 square kilometres and also has a lot of mountains. The size of Wales, for non-British listeners, is a popular yardstick, much used by the BBC when talking about very large objects like wandering icebergs, nuclear bomb blast devastation zones, and so on. The CIA World Factbook helpfully compares it to the state of Maryland. Per capita GDP, though, that's another story. The World Bank puts Albania's number at $5,200 per head, some way short of the comparable figure for Maryland, which is more than $70,000. The output per head of Albania's 2.8 million inhabitants is about the same as that of Colombia, and a bit more than half of Cuba's. Those figures are for today, more or less. The situation in the early 90s was nothing like as good. This was the CIA's take in the 1990 edition of the Factbook. Quote, overview. As the poorest country in Europe, Albania's development lags behind even the least favoured areas of the Yugoslav economy. The Stalinist-type economy operates on the principles of central planning and state ownership of the means of production. In recent years, Albania has implemented limited economic reforms to stimulate its lagging economy, although they do not go nearly as far as current reforms in the USSR and Eastern Europe. Attempts at self-reliance and a policy of not borrowing from international lenders, sometimes overlooked in recent years, have greatly hindered the development of a broad economic infrastructure. Albania, however, possesses considerable mineral resources and is largely self-sufficient in food. Numerical estimates of Albanian economic activity are subject to an especially wide margin of error because the government is isolated and close-mouthed. End quote. It put GMP at $3.8 billion, per capita GMP at 1,200, and there was no real growth rate available. One thing I want to make clear is that while we in the West were sneering at Albania, when we thought of it at all, as a nation of goat herds immersed in some nutty political doctrine, this was a nasty, nasty regime. According to a BBC World Service documentary, about a third of the population passed through its prisons and camps. The secret police were everywhere, and everything was controlled by the state. You could be executed if caught trying to escape, while just talking about leaving could get you tossed into a super harsh jail. This is a history podcast, so it isn't the place to go into the details of the cruelty and brutality of the Hoxha regime. But do have a listen to a documentary called Shadows of the Past on the BBC Sounds app. It's fascinating as well as shocking, and helps explain many of the scars that still afflict Albanian society today. On top of that, many of the same people running the show today, or their descendants, held important positions in the previous regime. Hello, and welcome to episode 13 of the Boom and Bust podcast. This is the story of how the promise of easy money gripped a population that was unaccustomed to the wiles of financial capitalism and fell for the glib promises of unscrupulous operators who were seeking to build business empires or just fancied filling their pockets with other people's money. The result was chaos, deaths, and a near civil war that did nothing to push forward development. For this next section, which gives the background to the post-communist economy, I'm leaning heavily on another report for the IMF. This one written by Chris Jarvis in 1999. Jarvis is currently a visiting scholar at the Blavatnik School of Government. That's in Oxford. I did ask him for comment, but he didn't reply to my emails. This, however, gives the background to the events that in the coming months would plunge the country into something like civil war. So the root of the problem was the banking system. This consisted of three state-owned banks, and it was rubbish, especially the payment system. Making a payment could take anything from 5 to 15 days or even more. So this was a cash economy. Lending, supervision and regulation were rudimentary. Loans from state banks weren't viewed as actually needing to be repaid. That meant that there were rising bad debts in the economy. And by the end of 1995, in two of the three banks, overdue loans were more than half of their books. The central bank therefore imposed a credit ceiling set well below what the banks wanted and what the economy needed. That led to a credit shortage, and that prompted businesses to move into the informal market. The organisations that were in the informal market also took deposits. This was illegal but tolerated. Indeed, it was viewed as benign given the uselessness of the state banks. And it was mainly based on remittances from migrant workers, involving very small loans with very high interest rates. So we should stop here and take a look, slightly closer look at what was going on in the economy as the transition out of communism got underway. Officially, money was tight as the authorities tried to rein in inflation. But high inflation, soaring unemployment, had prompted a sizable part of the workforce to emigrate, more than 10% of it. And they mainly went to Italy and Greece. These people sent money home, and these remittances accounted for as much as 20% of GDP. So there were savings. So as the transition got going, there was a population with savings to put to work, hopefully in a way that would beat inflation. A population that was new to capitalist ways of doing things, call it naive. And another part of the population that wasn't unfamiliar with gangsterism and the use of violence. On top of that, there was a good deal of corruption. Actually, there was huge corruption in government and among the elites. And these sorts of situations rarely end well, especially if governance is ineffective. The informal lending industry operated alongside other companies that also took deposits, but also invested for their own account rather than making loans. It was these that became the pyramid schemes that devoured the nation. Here, I'm just going to quote from Jarvis's IMF paper. Quote, "The first and largest of these companies were started in 1991-1992 and began collecting money shortly afterwards. During the period up to the end of 1995, these offered interest rates of 4-5% per month. The use to which they put their funds is uncertain. They engaged in some, usually highly visible, productive investments, and are in some cases also believed to have used borrowed funds to finance criminal activities, smuggling, illegal emigration, drugs, prostitution, and arms trafficking. Given the nature of these companies, it's not possible to establish whether they were ever solvent, in the sense of earning more from their investments and legal activities than they were paying to depositors. It is possible that they were pyramid schemes from the day they started business. In any event, if they were not so already, they became pyramid schemes in the course of 1996. The IMF distinguishes between the informal credit market, mostly good, and these pyramid companies, mostly evil. But in practice, the difference was difficult to spot in terms of getting to know anything about them. Indeed, trying to get information about the pyramid companies was actually dangerous. In 1995, an IMF consultant posed briefly as a potential investor and was quickly warned that this was not safe. Even so, the true nature of what was going on didn't become apparent to the international agencies working in the country until 1996, according to the IMF. But you have to suspect that this, in large part, was because the IMF and the other agencies didn't want to see what was happening under their noses. Why not? Well, between 1992 and 1996, Albania was the poster child for what is called the Washington Consensus on what a post-socialist transition to a capitalist economy should look like. The Washington Consensus typically refers to the view that free markets in a small state are the best ways for countries to spark economic development. But that's not a view shared by the fastest growing developing countries, which are mainly in Asia. Anyway, according to a paper by Dirk J. Bessemer of the Tinbergen Institute and University of Amsterdam, quote, by mid-1993, it could be claimed of Albania that it was the only country in Central and Eastern Europe that met every IMF criterion. In the years 1992 to 1996, Albania initiated the most free market policies in Europe and was considered a model country and master student of international institutions. Such praise was justified by reference to Albania's macroeconomic indicators. In the years 1993 to 1996, inflation was contained, GDP increased, and unemployment decreased considerably, end quote. Also, it's not like the pyramid schemes were able to become the monsters they turned into in secret. They had to advertise. They had to pull in new investors. As, indeed, Jarvis's IMF paper describes in an appendix on the mechanics of such schemes. Plus, if one of your consultants can't pose as a potential investor because it's too dangerous, you probably should start to smell a rat. But what is a pyramid scheme? Basically, money from a new quote-unquote investor is used to pay earlier investors. Sometimes this can involve people getting other people to flog, say, cleaning products or cosmetics to their pals, who are supposed to sell more of them on to their friends in turn. And so on. The Americans call this multi-level marketing, and some of them are sort of legal in many countries if there's a product involved. Ponzi schemes, instead, are named after a chap called Charles Ponzi, who operated a swindle back in 1919, and effectively these are what we saw in Albania. They are a sort of pyramid scheme in that cash from new investors goes to pay the original ones. Both types rely on there being new entrants to pay the old ones, and they unravel when the supply of new suckers runs out. And how do they attract new investors? Well, they raise the returns on offer. And when that rate loses its lure, they do it again, and again, and then again, and it spirals upwards. Eventually, someone stops and thinks, hey, this doesn't make any sense, and cashes out. Other people notice and follow suit. The scheme misses a payment because outflows exceed inflows, and the jig is up. Neratim Seyamimi, now editor-in-chief of Exit, an English-Albanian news website, was in Albania, his home, at the time. Quote, "There was a general get-rich-quick mentality in the entire population. I mean, a poor country suddenly opening up, no private activity, no private property, and suddenly people realised that they could have money, and they could get rich, and everything was permissible. Not just law enforcement institutions, but market institutions in general. They were non-existent." End quote. "There was freedom," he says, "and everyone was trying to benefit from that. For a population that had had no exposure to this kind of situation, this was paradise."
I mean, there were generations of Albanians which were raised under communism, and they, you know, didn't have even the slightest grasp of market economy operations, private property, exchanges, trade, etc. So a lot of them said, wow, this is what capitalism is all about. I mean, putting money somewhere and getting so much money back without doing anything.
It turned out that people were selling their assets, including their homes. Farmers were slaughtering their livestock, and so on, to raise money to invest in the schemes. Legitimate companies couldn't attract staff because potential recruits preferred to stay home and live off the interest. But all good things come to an end, and that's what happened in Albania, starting at the end of 1996. The collapse then took just 3 months. Some of the pyramid companies had managed to keep going for 4 years, and it was only in the final year that things span out of control. But why did they last so long? Now, this is how the IMF report puts it. Quote, "There is strong evidence that the problem was not just a legal one, but one of governance, and that members of the government themselves benefited from and supported the pyramid scheme companies. During the 1996 elections, several of the major companies made campaign contributions to the ruling Democratic Party and paid for advertisements on the election posters of Democratic Party candidates. Senior government officials frequently appeared at functions and parties organized by the companies, and in November 1996, even as the pyramid schemes began to crumble, the Prime Minister and Speaker of Parliament accepted medals to celebrate the fifth anniversary of VEFA, V-E-F-A, the largest company. This tolerance was reflected in the benign neglect of both the Ministry of Justice and the Ministry of Finance, and in open support of the major companies by the President. Thus, from September 1995 to July 1996, the Governor of the Bank of Albania stood virtually alone in Albania, urging investigation and closure of the schemes." End quote. So you can see how the pressure is building in the run-up to late 1996 when the bubble burst. The IMF points to two triggering factors. First, UN sanctions against the warring bits of former Yugoslavia were suspended in December 1995. This is important because, first, duties on oil that was legally imported into Albania were an important part of government revenue. And second, more significantly, it was a lovely little earner for the trading companies that smuggled the oil out of Albania and into Yugoslavia. With the sanctions lifted, the smuggling revenue disappeared and the pyramid schemes had to attract new money to replace it. How did they do that? A month after sanctions were lifted, they raised their interest rates to 6% per month. Also in early 1996, new pyramid schemes started to compete for deposits, putting upward pressure on interest rates. The three largest companies did have some real investments and activities. In 1996, they were joined by a couple of new schemes and an existing one that became much more active, offering rates of as much as 19% per month. The result was that new investors were drawn in and the existing schemes had to boost the rates they offered to utterly unsustainable levels. Jarvis's report for the IMF offers a rundown of the major schemes. I'm just going to read out a few details from descriptions, and I apologise in advance to any Albanian speakers out there for my mispronunciations. VEFA was the largest and most important of the companies, probably took in at least $700 million in deposits, probably over $1 billion. When it was taken over, its liabilities, and that's excluding interest, amounted to $250 million, while its assets were generously estimated at $30 million. Its president, Vebe Ali Mukai, was by most accounts attempting to build a business empire, but took a fateful decision to do so by raising cash at insupportable rates. Its assets included supermarkets, restaurants, a bitumen mine, a cruise ship, an entertainment complex, and a TV station. Yalika. This was a huge and massively fraudulent scheme. It started in 1991, began taking deposits, and it totaled about $850 million in deposits, with probably 80% or more of this coming in during 1996, when it was offering interest rates of about 10% a month. It had about 170,000 investors at its peak, with an average investment of about $5,000. When it collapsed, its liabilities were $343 million, its assets worth a mere $3 million. Its owners fled to Turkey in the company of $17 million US dollars. It was based in Vlorë, a city in southern Albania that we'll be coming back to, and its collapse triggered the first wave of violent civil disorder. Then there was Populli. This was a pure pyramid scheme. Early 1996 it began, and it had over 400,000 investors. In the end, it was offering to pay twice principal invested after 3 months. Its liabilities at the time of collapse were over $150 million. Much of its money was held in state banks and was actually seized by the authorities. Depositors got back 60% of their investments. Then there's Shafiri. This was started as a spin-off from Populli and actually grew faster and bigger. At the time of its collapse, its liabilities were over $300 million, and about half of this was returned to depositors from bank deposits. It went for a mass market. It posed as a benefactor, sponsored a football team, and it had nearly 1.5 million depositors, taking an average investment of about $250. At the end, it was offering three times principal after 3 months. Then there's a fun one called Sude. Maksude Kremi was a lady who started by running a lottery in the shoe factory where she worked. By the end, she was offering to double your money in 2 months. Sude was the first scheme to fold in November 1996, with liabilities at somewhere between $40 and $90 million, no assets. Considering that most of the deposits paid into Sude were made in the last 2 months of his operations, the disappearance of the assets is suspicious. And Muzkademi, according to the IMF, is currently serving a sentence of 3 years and 4 months for a conspiracy to defraud. So I should underline here that this is all based on the IMF account of events, and the IMF was an actor in this drama. So elections were due in May 1996. These were won by the Democratic Party, but were widely thought to be rigged, meaning that the government's authority was fragile, making it hard for the government to take difficult decisions. That meant that warnings from the World Bank and the IMF that this thing was getting out of hand weren't acted on. In October, the central bank discovered that VEFA, which we've seen as the biggest scheme, had $120 million on deposit in the state banks. Now, that's pocket change to a Bill Gates or Warren Buffett. But in post-communist Albania, it was equivalent to 5% of GDP. That's a 20th of the entire annual output of the economy. The warnings from the international agencies grew more strident, but most of the public just thought that the evil IMF was trying to do down Albanian success stories. When it was suggested that some of the schemes might be money laundries for the Italian mafia, the president defended them as legitimate and successful companies. Then, on November the 19th, an IMF mission held a press conference to warn of the dangers, and on that very same day, one of the schemes, SUDE, defaulted and the meltdown began. Confidence in the schemes faded, inflows of money dried up. In January, SUDE and Gallica, which, as we've seen, was based in the southern city of Vlore, both filed for bankruptcy. Riots took place in Vlore, setting the scene for what was to come as people's life savings vanished and their plans for the future crumbled. This dashing of people's hopes and plans mingled with dissatisfaction with the government, run by a gentleman called Sali Berisha. This is from the Human Rights Watch World Report from 1998 and refers to the events of 1997. Underlying the protests was dissatisfaction with Berisha's increasing authoritarianism and the fact that by the end of 1996, Albania had become a one-party state based on fear and corruption. The DP, the Democratic Party, controlled the executive, the judiciary and legislative branches of the government, as well as the police security service, the SHIK, and electronic media. In January 1997, the government responded to the growing protests with repression and force. Demonstrations were banned, and the police beat and detained hundreds of protesters, especially in the south, where the dissatisfaction with Berisha was most intense. On television, Berisha accused the protesters of being, quote-unquote, red bandits, working in collaboration with, quote-unquote, Albania's traditional enemies. The secret police harassed key opposition politicians, journalists and government critics, whom the state-run media were blaming for inciting the crisis. At least 8 people were physically attacked by unknown assailants, believed to be the secret police, during January and February, including the independent writer Idi Rama and Socialist Party activist Ndrej Legzi, both of whom were seriously injured. In all cases, the police failed to conduct an adequate investigation. The government undertook increasingly repressive measures in January and February as the demonstrations grew more violent and angry mobs ransacked the DP headquarters and municipal buildings in towns across the south. From January 26th to the 30th, the police and SHIK made wide-scale arrests in the southern towns of Lushnje, Berat and Korsa. Many people were taken from their homes in the middle of the night without an arrest warrant and held for 3 to 4 days in unspecified locations. Upon their release, many reported physical abuse and torture. Journalists also came under increasing attack, especially Albanians working with foreign news agencies. Correspondents with Reuters, Associated Press and the BBC were followed, received threatening phone calls from identified persons believed to work for the state. Some of them were detained by the police or had their equipment and notebooks confiscated during demonstrations. A number of them fled the country out of fear for their lives. End quote. But the authorities did begin to understand the danger the country was in. In January, the bank accounts of 2 other schemes were frozen. These contained the 250 million referred to. That's an amount equivalent to 10% of GDP. The central bank imposed rules limiting withdrawals to 30 million lex, that's about $300,000 a day, aiming to prevent promoters of other schemes from emptying their accounts. However, this was a figure per account, and the schemes held numerous accounts, meaning there was plenty of room for fraud, including by buying assets from related parties at inflated prices. And unfortunately, the authorities didn't act against all the schemes. Vefa, for example, was allowed to continue advertising during the worst of the violence, according to the IMF. Here's Seyamimi.
People started attacking the army depots and they started to arm themselves. At that moment, everything became loose. Everybody suddenly had a weapon. Everybody felt like he had a right to protect himself. And then in such conditions, when the government is non-existent, then you have the crime or you have the bad guys that take everything under control. And this led to a lot of social turmoils, but this led also to a lot of criminal activities and killings for other reasons, benefiting from the situation.
Reuters photographer Yanis Berakis was covering the unrest following the pyramid scheme failures. He and a colleague were staying in a hotel in an area where bandits were taking advantage of the chaos and would rob any unprotected journalist. The owner of the hotel, who was himself armed, insisted on placing Kalashnikovs and hand grenades in the closets of the journalists' rooms, apparently for their own protection. That's an illustration of the chaos, the depth of the unrest that the situation had provoked. By early March, deaths from the violence were heading towards the 2000 mark, and almost a million weapons had been looted. The disorder spread to Tirana, the capital, in late March, and the government resigned. New elections were called for the end of June, and an interim all-party government led by the opposition Socialist Party was formed. But the government's authority was shaky. Parliament was still dominated by the Democratic Party, and President Berisha was resisting taking action against the remaining schemes. Great chunks of the country had slipped out of the government's control. Armories were looted by rioters in the more prosperous south, where investment in the schemes was highest, and by supporters of the president in the north. The army and the police had in large part deserted, and a refugee crisis was brewing. The government was also broke. Its revenue had collapsed. After all, who's going to pay tax in those circumstances? And anyway, tax offices and customs posts had been burned down. In the first half of the year, the lek had plunged 40% against the dollar, and inflation was 28%, according to the IMF. In a 2017 paper called Pyramid Firms and Value Transformation in Post-Socialist Albania, Smoki Musrai tells the story of a lady called Manjola from a village near Vlora in the south of the country. The piece illustrates the impact of the collapse of the pyramids on people's lives. In 1992, Manjola and her husband left the village to work in Greece, she as a cleaner, he in construction. They returned in 1996, lured in part by the excitement surrounding the pyramid schemes. Her husband got a job as a taxi driver while she looked after the cash deposited with the firms on her own and her family's behalf. That made sense because the more cash you put in as a lump sum, the better the rate. And the other family members were working abroad, sending money home anyway. Citing the EBRD, Musrai reports that in 1995, remittances accounted for 16% of GDP. Manjola's money was caught up in the January collapses and she lost her house and her money just as the unrest started. She and her husband lost the equivalent of $80,000, leaving aside any lost interest payments, she claims. Quote, "It was the sweat of my and my husband's work," end quote. She had demolished her home in order to build a new one, funded by 4 years of savings that were now gone. Her husband was forced to return to Greece for work, and many years later, the conversation took place in 2008, many years later he was still there. In April, the socialist-led interim government asked an international force led by Italy to help restore order. The 6,000-strong force, which according to Siamimi was generally welcomed, stabilised things in the north and in the capital, Tirana. Tax collection restarted and the IMF moved back in, overseeing a reform programme that helped the lek appreciate 20% by the end of the year and reduced inflation to 11%. To ensure that the winding up of the schemes wasn't informed by local rivalries, there was a sort of foreign takeover. Administrators from international accounting firms were appointed and given wide powers over the schemes, including asset sales, hiring and firing, the power to seize assets, including of individuals, and to hire experts. Naturally, the operators of the schemes weren't overjoyed and tried to obstruct things as much as possible, both through the courts and with threats of violence. However, the assistance of the operators of the schemes was also vital in order to locate the assets these schemes had invested in. That all delayed the winding up of the schemes, with the result that the recovery was lower than hoped. If you're selling a business into a depressed economy where the rule of law isn't really present, and with the potential for the buyer to face retaliation by previous owners, the price you'll get isn't going to be very high. In contrast, the government's seizing of the cash the schemes had banked gave better results than trying to dispose of real assets. These days, a quarter of a century on from the events covered here, Albania is less of a Wild West and more of a transition economy. It joined NATO in 2009 and is a candidate for membership of the EU, but it remains small and, by European standards, impoverished, with colourful Balkan habits such as blood feuds that go through generations and that are proving tough to end. Joining the EU is an ambition that isn't going to be realised for many, many years to come. We'll end the episode here. If you enjoyed it and want more of my dulcet tones, you'll find other episodes on iTunes, Stitchers, Google, and wherever else you cast your pod. Do subscribe. Rate and review it, as doing so helps other people find the podcast, especially on iTunes. As ever, the guitar music used is by Clive Carroll. It's a piece called All This Time from his album Life in Colour. Thanks again for listening, and tune in next time.